Good morning and welcome to the October 13th, 2025 edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, everyone.
Nice, crispy morning out there. We're going to start our hour by talking about one of my favorite books of the year, Kevin. It's a book by author Matthew Algeo about his book, The Secret Subway.
And then we'll hear about what's new at Versanti from Chef Casey Savage and Food and Beverage Operations Manager Andrew McKay. And we'll finish our show with Delilah Gervais from Splendor out there in Redstone, celebrating 20 years in business. All this and more on Mountain Money. Stay tuned.
For most of us, the term subway conjures up images of the iconic New York City subway system. But before the IRT, there was actually an underground pneumatic train system that briefly ran a short distance underneath Broadway. That story is told in a fascinating new book by Matthew Algeo, New York's Secret Subway. We're very lucky to be joined by the author this morning. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Morning, guys. It's great to be with you.
So what motivated you to write this book and how long did it take to do the research?
Back in 2020, during the pandemic, I did a lot of listening to playlists on Spotify. I came across a Canadian prog rock band called Klopptube, which didn't achieve much success, but they did write a song called Sub Rosa Subway. And it's actually a song about Alfred Beach and his construction of a secret pneumatic tube subway under Broadway in New York in 1870. Not typical prog rock subject matter, but it really got me interested in this story. I couldn't believe it was true. I hadn't really heard anything about it, and that just sent me down the rabbit hole. And the more you started digging into this story, the crazier it seemed to get. And I guess, 5 years later, I've published a book about it. So I kind of became infatuated with the story after learning about it during the pandemic. And it took, it takes about a year or two to do the research, to do the proposal, and then you got to sell the book, and then you get a contract, and then it takes another year, a year and a half to do the writing. So it's been on my mind at least for the past 5 years.
Well, the central character in the book is really a pretty fascinating guy, this guy, Alfred Eli Beach. Can you share a bit about Beach and his career in the world of invention?
Yeah, so Alfred Beach is born in 1826. His father owned the New York Sun, so they were a fairly wealthy family. And Beach grew up in a world of privilege. I mean, Walt Whitman came over to his house for dinner, But he was He loved tinkering. He loved inventing. He loved making devices. And in 1845, when he was just 19, the opportunity came along to purchase Scientific American, which was a brand new publication at the time. It was only about a year old, was experiencing financial trouble. Beach and a friend bought this magazine. Of course, Scientific American still exists today. Beach would be the editor of it for about 50 years. And he would really turn Scientific American into a place for American inventors to go for information about the newest inventions. If they had questions, they had a question and answer column there. I mean, really before any kind of, there were only four engineering schools in the country. I mean, there really weren't many resources for inventors. And so Beach really gave inventors a place to go. And then on top of that, he opened a patent agency where he represented some of the most famous American inventors of the 19th century, Bell, Edison, Morse. They all went to Alfred Beach to help him to get their patents. They helped him. He helped them get their patents. And in fact, the Beach Agency accounted for about a third of all patents that were issued in the 1860s and 1870s. I mean, it's just phenomenal. And then on top of that, Beach himself was an inventor. He invented a typewriter, an early version of a typewriter. He invented one of my favorite things, which was the indoor bowling alley, where you could roll the pin. He shortened the length of the alley by putting in two loop-de-loops, like a Hot Wheels track. And so you roll the bowl and go through the two loops and then knock the pins over, which I don't think the neighbors would have been crazy about, but you could fit it into an apartment. So he was always kind of inventing on his own on the side. And so when he saw how bad the problem was with congestion in New York City in the 1860s, he decided to try to do something about it.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. Paint us a picture of the development of Lower Manhattan and how the streets were working and how could people get their business done?
Yeah, so Lower Manhattan, especially, you know, in the 1820s, 1830s, really was concentrated at the very bottom tip of Manhattan. You could get anywhere that you needed to get in Manhattan by walking, right? Nothing was more than a mile away. But as the city grew, as it started growing north on the island of Manhattan, transportation became an issue. You needed to have some form of public transportation. The streets were so crowded, it's just impossible for us to comprehend right now. There were wagons making deliveries. There were stagecoaches called omnibuses. There were horse-drawn streetcars. There were private vehicles. There were vendors. There were people hawking hard-boiled eggs and oysters and corn on the cob. It was just, you couldn't cross the street at midday on Broadway. It would have been impossible. There were no traffic control devices. They didn't have stop signals, of course. They didn't even have stop signs. They weren't even quite sure which side of the road to drive on yet. So it was just traffic moving both ways, both lanes, just absolutely insane. And so it took hours to go. Sometimes the horse-drawn streetcars would move 2 miles an hour. It would have been faster to walk, except you still had to navigate all the pedestrian traffic as well. And so it was just obvious that New York needed a better solution to the transportation problem.
And so Beach comes up with this idea of using this pneumatic train. Can you sort of explain how that works?
Yeah, so in 1863, London opened an underground railway, the first subway in the world. Those carriages, passenger cars, were pulled by steam locomotives. Now, you can imagine in a tunnel, a steam locomotive is not ideal because the locomotives expel cinders, ashes,
carbon monoxide.
It's not a great situation. So to alleviate that in London, they tried to ventilate the tunnels as much as they could. This would not be as easy to do in New York. So Beach knew that the best way to do it was to build an underground rail system, a subway system. But he knew there had to be a better way than steam. And really in the 1840s and 1850s, a lot of people see pneumatics as the next great mode of locomotion. Pneumatics were kind of discovered in the principle of using air pressure to move things through tubes, kind of came around in the 18th century. There was a British inventor who envisioned building tubes that would shoot passenger cars. Of course, the logistics of that are very difficult. You have to have an airtight tube and a real powerful fan. But Beach figured New York would be the place to do it. You know, the island's not that big. You could put stations every 10 blocks or so, put a fan at each station and blow these carriages through these giant pneumatic tubes, essentially. He envisioned an 8-foot tube, and you'd make a passenger car that was perfectly round that would fit inside the tube. You got a giant blower. You blow the car up to the next station, and then you could reverse the blower and pull the car from the previous station up to the station. So it was practical. I mean, it was doable. But it definitely was a cutting-edge technology for the time.
And you talk in the book a lot about how things like that business of having to seal it as much as possible, having the sort of fringe or circle around the car so that no air could go around. I assume that had to be some kind of fabric or some way to sort of allow it to move,
right,
but still be as airtight as possible.
So there were inventors came up with all kinds of ways to do this, because you're right. You want to keep the car, the car should occupy as much space as it can. You don't want to waste any air pressure by blowing it around the car. So the car should be as big as the tube it's in. One of the ways they did this was putting bristles around the edge of the car. Imagine a lion's mane, right? Just put big, huge bristles all around the car, and then that would close the space between the car and the tunnel. That had some problems too, though, because inevitably you would brush up against the sides of the tunnel with these bristles, and that might slow the car down. Beach actually built his car as close as he could to the size of the tunnel, but it still had to negotiate turns. See, that was the problem. And that's the problem too with the bristle the Bristol solution too, you still have to negotiate turns. And so he was able to engineer the turns and the size of the car to fit just right. But it was precision engineering, and it wasn't easy to do in 1869 or 1870. And he's building all this basically on his own.
And paying for it on his own.
Right. So Beach had to keep it secret. We can get into that. But the fact of the matter is he knew he would never get permission from the powers that were in New York at the time. Tammany Hall, Boss Tweed, all the stagecoach and horse-drawn streetcar companies paid kickbacks to Boss Tweed to keep out any competition. And so Beach knew he could never get a charter. So he had to build this, design this, engineer this, basically in secret so nobody would know about it until he was ready to unveil it to the public. And as a result, it made it difficult for him to go out and get funding.
Yeah.
It's hard to go out and look for venture capitalists to fund in something which is basically illegal, or going to build an illegal subway in New York. So he funded most of this out of his own personal wealth. I estimate probably about $400,000 to $500,000, which of course was a tremendous amount of money in 1869 and 1870. Probably half of his wealth went into this. And I actually managed to track down his great times four or five, I forget, granddaughter who lives in Florida. And she told me the family still rues the decision that Beach made to spend all their fortune on a stupid pneumatic tube subway. But anyway, he thought it was worthwhile and didn't really care, I guess, what the great, 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 great grandkids would think.
Well, one of the things that I really loved about this book was, in addition to running into characters like Edison and Bell, we also ran into the guy, Boss Tweed, who you just mentioned. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't stop and talk for a minute about who Boss Tweed was and how he operated.
Yeah, so Boss Tweed grew up in a Scotch-Irish family. I think he was maybe 2 years older than Alfred Beach. I think he was born in 1824. But he became a very famous and powerful politician in New York. A lot of people think he was mayor of New York City. He never was. He usually held much lower positions, but he would hold several at once. He was on the Streets Commission. He was on the Education Commission. He did serve on the Board of Aldermen for a time. He was also a state senator. So he really kept his fingers in a lot of pies, and he was the master of political graft. He and his cronies you had the power to award city contracts for building a new wharf or building a new sidewalk or paving a street. Anything that had to be done in the city required a contract. And so Tweed and the Tweed Ring would award contracts to people they knew who would grossly overbid the price. They would end up then getting paid $10,000 for a $1,000 job and then give Tweed and his cronies $6,000 out of that. It was a pretty simple racket, actually. They ended up building a new courthouse when Boss Tweed was in power. That ended up, I think, costing twice as much as the Alaska Purchase. It was like $14 million. It took 25 years to build. Plasterer got $10,000 a day working on this courthouse. Astronomical sums. It's funny that the courthouse is now the Department of Education for New York City, but in New York City, it's still known as the Tweed Courthouse. I mean, 150 years later, people still remember this guy. That's how corrupt he was. So that was the obstacle that Alfred Beach faced. He had to overcome this guy who was very powerful and did not like to be trifled with.
And one more Tweed question. You talk about how one of the ways Tweed maintained his political power was by marshaling the votes of Irish immigrants.
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of people also assume Tweed was Irish. He wasn't, actually. His family was Scottish. But he allied himself with the Irish immigrant community in such a way that he really, their loyalty to him was unquestioned. And he rewarded them. Irish immigrants could go to Tweed for some coal in the winter if they didn't have money to buy coal or maybe even a turkey if they were didn't have food. They could also go to Tweed for jobs. Being a policeman was one of the first occupations that were open to Irish immigrants in New York in the 1860s and 1870s, and that was through Tweed. And so the Irish were completely loyal to Tweed. And Tweed made sure the Irish were able to vote. They would naturalize hundreds of people before election day. I mean, election judges. At the time, you could go to any judge, could administer naturalization. So they would go into Tweed-friendly courtrooms with Tweed-friendly judges and bring in 500 people and have them all naturalized 2 days before election day. And then those guys might vote at three or four different polling places because it was impossible to keep track of how people voted at the time. And so, yeah, Tweed really leaned into the Irish community in New York, and they rewarded him.
So let's talk a little bit about how he went ahead and built the railroad. He had some kind of authorization at the state level to build something that I take it would carry mail. Can you explain what he had and then what he did?
Right. So Tweed had a cover story. Beach.
Yeah.
Alfred Beach. Right. I get these guys mixed up. Beach is the good guy. Beach had a cover story. And Beach's cover story was he was going to build a pneumatic tube system that would carry mail. And so he was only going to build small, I think it was 54-inch tubes that would carry these little wagons that would shoot from the post office to the train station. So the train station comes in, gets the mail. You put the mail in one of these wagons. Poof, it shoots down the tube to the post office. So he did win a charter to build this pneumatic tube system for delivering mail. But that was really just a cover. What he did when he went down there and started excavating is he decided, well, maybe instead of building two 54-inch tubes, I should just build one giant tube to put the two smaller tubes in. And that one giant tube was about 8 feet across. And then I say in the book, this is what Tweed's explanation was. The need for a rapid passenger railway in New York was so much more pressing than the demand for a freight line that the company determined to construct a tunnel and prepare a portion thereof as an experimental passenger railway. So they just decided to go ahead and build a stretch of passenger railway. The idea being that Beach would build this demonstration line. It was only about 300 feet. It just went down the block. But when people saw it, they would be so enamored of it that the public outcry to expand this line, to extend it the length of the island, would be so great that it would overcome any political opposition from Tweed or anybody else.
And did Beach give passenger rides for that first 300 feet as a way to, instead of just showing it to them, did they take rides?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. He built a passenger carriage. He really wanted to make everything first class. He wanted to impress people. It has to be remembered that public transportation was so bad. These street-drawn horse cars were so slow. They were filthy. They were freezing in the winter. They were hot in the summer. They were always crowded. The horses generated a lot of waste, right? Tons of it dropped on the street every day. We talk about how the steam engines polluted the tunnels. The horses polluted the streets. It was really kind of gross how dirty the streets were. So Tweed really wanted to make this stand in contrast to all that. So he actually built this grand waiting room. Had a waiting room with a grand piano and a goldfish-filled fountain and settees and a private waiting area for the ladies. And then he had the plush car with the 22 upholstered seats inside this little tubular car. People would get in, and then the giant fan would start, and it would blow them. But at first, it was so gentle. That was another thing. The horse cars were always lurching. Every time the horses pulled up, jerk the car. This was so gentle, you barely even perceived that you were moving. There was one visitor from Iowa said it was like the sound of the wind rustling through the corn. And then you would just gently move down to the tunnel, slowly gaining speed. And then they had a handbrake and they stopped it. They would reverse the fan and it would just as gently suck you back. I mean, for people accustomed to riding the stagecoaches and the horse-drawn streetcars, this was fantastic. It was clean. It was quiet. That's the other thing about the Broadway. It was so loud between the horses and the vendors. It was clean. It was quiet. It was 20 feet underground, so it was cool in the summer and warm in the winter. And it was comfortable. You know, such a finely appointed car that was, it was bound to win a lot of support from people. Beach charged 25 cents a ride, but he was pretty, he gave that to an orphanage. He was pretty clever about promotion. So he donated all the proceeds to an orphanage. And the acclaim was fantastic. It really was. Thousands of people, tens of thousands of people signed petitions that went to the state legislature, said, please give him permission to build this out, to run it the length of the island.
And how fast did this first 300 feet go? What was the top speed?
Well, the top speed probably was, it didn't have much room to get to a top speed. So I would say it was probably 10 miles an hour. He dreamed that you could make a pneumatic subway run at distance at 60 miles an hour, which at that time was, I don't think anything had ever moved 60 miles an hour. So it would be so much faster than what was used up on the street.
Okay, so it's a big hit. By the way, one of the other things that was wonderful in the book was some of the engineering challenges that they faced in trying to do this in secret. Like, how do you get the dirt out so people don't know you're doing a giant tunnel? How do you ensure that you're actually underneath Broadway? Like, you're underground. What kind of boring machines did they use? So I want to just ask, the one question is, how did they know they were on the right place? How did they know they were underneath Broadway?
So this is cool. This is one of the things I learned researching the book, is that there are very sophisticated devices now for tunneling and mining. When you're underground, they have devices that can, like GPS for underground, can tell you exactly where you are. When Alfred Beach was building this tunnel, what they would do is at night, they would take a rod and stick it up through the top of the tunnel and poke it into the middle of Broadway to see if they were still on track to be in the center of Broadway. That's what they would do every night to make sure they were. So when you consider the technology or the lack of technology at the time to accomplish this feat, to build a tunnel that was perfectly straight, perfectly centered down the middle of Broadway, was an achievement in itself. Yeah.
Okay. So this thing is built. It's popular. People are flocking to it. My guess is there's great write-ups in the newspapers. Why wasn't he allowed to build it up?
Boss Tweed is the answer. I mean, Boss Tweed controlled the state legislature at that time. It was a Democratic legislature. More importantly, he controlled the governor. John Hoffman was a former New York City mayor who was elected governor. So twice, Beach was able to win charters in the legislature, the New York State House and Senate, the Assembly and the Senate voted to award him a charter in 1871 and 1872, and this would have allowed him to extend the line the length of Broadway. But John Hoffman, who was the governor, who was in Tweed's pocket, of course, Tweed was controlled by the streetcar companies. In fact, Tweed himself was on the board of one of the horse-drawn streetcar companies. So acting on Tweed's instructions, I believe, Hoffman vetoed the bills that would have given Beach the charters in 1871 and 1872. In 1871, the Beach Ring was finally overthrown. There was a disaffected employee who was, you know, disgruntled because he hadn't been paid off what he thought he should have been paid off. And he took some of the ledgers to the New York Times, and it came out that they were paying these guys $10,000 a day to plaster the courthouse. And so Tweed was finally overthrown. And then Beach did win the charter again in 1873. This time the new governor signed it. Everything seemed to be headed for the completion of the first complete subway system in New York. And then that great killer of 19th century dreams, the financial panic, came along, right? We've always got one of these panics in the 1800s. It seems to be anytime something gets going, there's a financial panic. Well, Jay Gould tried to corner the market on gold. It didn't work, but the price of gold plummeted. And this resulted in the stock market crashing, and there just wasn't any money available. Beach went overseas in 1873. His brother went to Europe to try to raise money for this project. But of course, the Europeans were skeptical now that New York had been exposed as the center of corruption in the United States. People were reluctant to give money for these quixotic little public transportation projects in the capital of corruption. And so, unfortunately, it would be another 30 years at least before New York finally did get a subway.
Are there any vestiges of this tunnel or the secret subway left?
Man, I looked.
I'm sure
there was a fire. Yeah, I spent a lot of time on Broadway between Warren and Bury Streets. The building where the waiting house, the waiting room was, the really fancy one with the goldfish fountain and everything, the building that was in the basement of caught on fire and collapsed in 1898 and crushed what would have been there anymore. We don't even know if anything was, but if it was, that was it. It was gone. But when they were clearing the rubble from the fire, they discovered the tunnel. And the tunnel was still there in 1899. And the old carriage was at the end of it, deteriorating. In fact, Beach's grandson went down and was photographed inside the old Beach pneumatic carriage. So we know it was there in 1899. And then finally, the tunnel basically was used as part of the New York City Hall subway station. So when you're standing on the platform of the New York City Hall subway station today, you're basically standing inside the Beach Tunnel. That's where it was. In fact, the platform of the City Hall station is longer than the Beach Tunnel was. I'm saying 500 feet. Beach Tunnel was only 300 feet. Now, I have a friend who has been looking for some remnants and actually talked his way into the building where above where the Beach
the other end.
Station was, right? Yeah, that was rebuilt. They built a new building. It's a co-op, you know, it's like $2 million apartments in there. But he talked his way in and he got in the basement and he's convinced there's still something there. Maybe just a few feet of a brick-lined tunnel that might still be there, but it's been covered up over the years and is inaccessible now. It would be somewhere between the center of Broadway and Warren Street. So it's possible there's something there. But as far as physical remnants, parts of the car allegedly went to the IRT, which was the precursor of the modern subway system in New York, but I had no luck finding that. The giant tunneling shield, the boring machine that Beach built, was still largely intact in 1899, and it was sent to Cornell, and then it was sent to the Henry Ford Museum in Dearborn, but they have no record of it ever getting there. There's a plaque in the building that stands above where the station was now. It's attached to the mailbox in the foyer. So you can go see that, but you have to ask somebody to let you in.
All right. The book is New York's Secret Subway, The Underground Genius of Alfred Beach and the Origins of Mass Transit. We've had a wonderful time speaking with the author, Matthew Algeo. Thanks for spending time with us.
You are welcome. Enjoyed it. Thanks, guys.
If you listen to our show often, you know that we like food. Eating it, making it, talking about it, food brings us together as families, friends, strangers who may become friends. Many of us are familiar with Versanti. It's at the Peaks Hotel just as you're coming into town on the corner of Park and Holiday Ranch Loop. But lately, you see a lot of construction at the Peaks and you wonder, is Versanti open? To quell the confusion and to learn what's coming soon at Versanti, we're joined by Chef Casey Savage and Food and Beverage Operations Manager Andrew McKay. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. And what's in the bag?
In the bag.
We got some
turkey clubs here for you guys.
Some turkey.
These are a little special that we're running for our October Dinabout menu.
So I'll let you guys check these out. Here's made for you.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, we're going to jump in with Andrew. Is Versanti open for business right now?
We are, yeah. We had a slight closure due to the construction, but that was back in July, and we've been crawling our way back into people's minds the last month and a half. So yeah, we're open. We're open Wednesday through Sunday from 5 to 9 right now.
Has it been remodeled on the inside?
A little bit of work on the entryway, but the rest of the restaurant is the exact same.
Excellent. So, and what are your hours?
5 to 9 every Wednesday through Sunday. So excellent. We're just closed on Mondays and Tuesdays right now.
And you're not open for lunch?
No, not for lunch, no.
And will you end up opening the other 2 days a week later in the season? What's your plan?
We will. So as soon as the hotel construction is complete and the hotel transition has been made, then we're going to reopen 7 days a week.
Wonderful. So you are the food and beverage operations manager. What does that entail?
So I just oversee everything food and beverage that happens inside the hotel. So we have a banquets department. We do a lot of caterings, in-house caterings, and then just the restaurant itself, and then our breakfast operation that goes on for the hotel guests during the winter.
Oh, so the breakfast is for hotel guests.
Yeah, we're hoping to open it to the public this winter. It has not been open to the public in the past, but it's something that we're working towards for this winter when we become hotel things and for Sante.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. We sort of breezed over that. There is a transition going on at the hotel. Can you explain what that is?
So a few years ago, the hotel was sold to a new ownership, and it's been in the works since then, but we have gone under a complete renovation of all public spaces, and this winter we will no longer be Park City Peaks, and we will start as a Hotel Thanes, a tribute portfolio under the Marriott umbrella.
And Casey, so I understand you attended Pitmaster School.
Yes, so I used to work for a barbecue place. It was a chain temporarily in Heber for a little while, Dickie's Barbecue Pit. While I was there, they offered me a Pitmaster program, kind of a level up type thing to help me advance my skill set in the barbecue world. So they just had me take some courses and work with some pit masters and learn some things. And eventually I decided I like doing barbecue more than I like doing other things and just stuck with that for a little while.
Wonderful. Well, that's been a great experience.
It was fun. It was a lot of fun. High pace, a lot of energy, lots of cool people. So
excellent.
Now, does that bode for the potential for some barbecue-related menu items at Versante?
I absolutely would love to try to bring in some kind of barbecue somewhere in there. Right now, I've actually got a winter barbecue chicken pizza I'm working on. So it's got a little bit of holiday flavor to it and a little bit of barbecue. So.
And traditionally, well, let's talk about what the traditional menu at Versante is. How would you sort of characterize it?
It's more of like a laid-back, kind of a casual Italian type menu. So the menu kind of ranges. We do everything from classic Italian to kind of modern American, modern Italian food. I mean, we've been throwing a little bit of everything out there just to try to get some kind of attention. So yeah, we're just kind of playing around right now.
And you're the new chef?
I am the new chef.
But yes. You've been working there on and off since they opened?
Pretty much. I mean, I've been there since the beginning of 2018. I was there until about, I want to say 2022, and then took a little break. Went and played with some barbecue for a little while, and then I came back, and now I've taken over.
Good. And besides barbecue, what are some of your specialties?
Really? I mean, barbecue is kind of where I think I shine the most. It's where I've had the most training, so I think that's really kind of where I shine the most. I love Italian food. I love the simplicity of it, so I think it's definitely something that, you know, shouldn't be too hard to really master. I mean, I've been doing it for a while anyway, so I think... I just
don't sell yourself short. You got a good handle on it already. Thank you.
I've been around it a little while. So I think we'll make some magic happen.
So Andrew, Dynabout is coming around.
Mm-hmm.
Are you guys participating?
We are. So we're participating at the dinner level with the $45 3-course menu. But we're also letting everybody break that down and order items individually if they want to.
Tell us what are the options on the 3-course menu if you've already decided.
So for the first course, we have a vegetarian roasted cauliflower soup or some arancini balls, which Casey and our sous chef, Ray, spent a lot of time tweaking and making sure that they are awesome. They've got some sea hive cheese in the center of them, a really nicely seasoned risotto, and then, you know, the panko on the outside. And then we're doing some marinara and a little bit of a cilantro cream cheese on the top just to give them a little pop of color. And those are fantastic. And then for the second course, it's this turkey club that you guys are dipping into right now with a juniper aioli, some lettuce, tomato, onion, bacon, white cheddar, and then, of course, our famous fries that everybody raves about.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also have a jumbo 3-cheese ravioli with a portobello cream sauce on there, which is fantastic. And then for dessert, we're just going pretty simple. We've got a nice vanilla ice cream with raspberry sorbet as one of the options, or you can do a New York-style cheesecake that's got some peach coulis and a raspberry sauce on top, and that coulis is fantastic. It's got some of those fall flavors mixed into it, so get a little cinnamon, a little spice.
And when does that start?
Oh, so yeah, let's start it on the 1st.
And is it going to go for the entire month?
Yeah, we're going to run it for the whole month. Yeah, so Dynabout started on the 1st, so we launched that on Wednesday, October 1st.
So yeah, the sandwich looks like a club, but it tastes, it's extraordinary.
So the juniper aioli is definitely what is the noticeable factor there. The juniper aioli, I actually learned from another chef that I worked with recently. She has a brilliant rustic menu and taught me some of her things. And then I just kind of pulled some things off of what I learned from her and turned it into my own. So I think the juniper aspect to it, it's got a nice mountain rustic vibe to it. I think it'll draw a lot of attention to just the general idea and the idea of the sandwich. So
exactly. So as a chef, you are not just teaching others, you are learning. You are continue to learn.
Right. It's a constant, I mean, you have to be really arrogant to think you already know everything as a chef. You know what I mean? It's one of those things that you're constantly learning. You're constantly being challenged. There's curveballs always being thrown at you, and you just have to adapt to it and learn.
Gotcha. So I'm going to jump back to the Dynabout. So it's the ravioli is vegetarian, right?
Yeah, it's vegetarian. It's not vegan, but it is vegetarian. And then the cauliflower soup that is on there, that is a vegan soup.
That sounds fantastic.
It can be vegan. We put cheese on it, but it can be optional without it. So
gotcha. And the restaurant in general has vegan and vegetarian options. And do you have gluten-free pizza?
Oh, absolutely. All of our pizzas are offered gluten-free. Most of our pastas are gluten-free as well, or can be. Mm-hmm. But we don't really have a lot of vegan things on there quite yet, but that's something I'm working on.
And what else is in your drawing board in terms of potential new items to add this winter?
Right now, I'm kind of just taking it step by step and focusing on now. Mm-hmm. But I think for the winter time, I would definitely love to try to bring in some more warm home style rustic meals. I really want to try to slow down the service of Versante a little bit and make it more, not like a rushed experience. I want it to be more laid back and quiet.
You know, we talk to a lot of restaurants on the show. And one thing I'm always curious about, as a chef, as a manager of other cooks, how do you ensure consistency? You know, what devices do you use to make sure that everybody makes it? You want it to stay the same no matter who was working that day.
Right, right.
How do you do that?
So we do, we follow the same rule as most kitchens. We have recipes and standards that we try to enforce it the best that we can. Obviously, it's you know, sometimes there's a hiccup, but occasionally, you know, it happens. So, but I mean, for the most part, we do have standards, we have logs, we have paperwork that we document everything with and try to, you know, push it as...
How many chefs are there? How many people run the kitchen?
Right now, there's me, the executive chef, and then I have my sous chef, Ray. Mm-hmm. And then Andrew also is here to kind of help with the kitchen.
You get your hands dirty, Andrew?
You get in there? Time to time, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, excellent. I didn't know that.
So again, you're going to be open 7 nights. Obviously, you're going to have other... There are going to be nights when you're not running the kitchen, I take it. Are you going to be there most nights?
Everybody needs a day off. So, there's going to be, right now we have kind of a fixed schedule for everybody since we're only open 5 out of the 7 days of the week. So, we kind of just take advantage of that time. But once the season picks up, we'll just kind of like rotate it to what's fair for me and my sous chef. Just kind of switch out slower days and do what we can from there.
So after the closure in July and kind of a remodel, are you still seating the same number of people or did you increase it all?
We're at the same. We're actually running a reduced seating capacity right now just to keep people away from where the construction's going on and away from the entryway. But we haven't expanded. What we'll have at the front now is more of a expanded waiting area with some couches and more of a loungy feel than the park benches that we kind of had at the front beforehand.
Is it going to be the same area or are we going to go into the lobby a little bit?
We've gained about 6 feet at the front of the restaurant.
Mm. Okay.
But it's all entryway. So, and we're getting a brand new host area and the entryway is... It's just basically the entryway from the hotel has changed, but the main entryway from outside, that is all exactly the same.
You know, during the pandemic, Andrew, Versante was a remarkable place because it had all that wonderful outdoor seatings and you guys did a great job at being a gathering place when people couldn't gather otherwise. Are there any plans to sort of revitalize that outdoor space?
So we have some plans. The ownership was thinking about developing that space, I believe, and so it was kind of put on the back burner. But we've been given the go-ahead to try and come up with some ideas for next summer to try and activate that space. And we're working on some workarounds for the issues that we'd come up in the past that had kind of limited what we were able to do out there. So, but Park City has a lot of different restrictions and things, but they also have different permits. So we're looking at
try to bring it back next year, possibly.
Yeah, with some different permits than we were using the last year. Before, it was an extension of the restaurant, and now we're looking for some special event kind of things going on out
there. Also, I wonder if you can put a barbecue pit back there.
You have smoked a pig back there.
Yeah, we did do a pig a couple years back. That was a lot of fun. I would love to have some kind of a pit back there. I've been begging for a smoker, so we'll see if we can make it work.
Okay, now how about the bar? Is the bar still in there?
The bar's still in there. The bar's going nowhere. We actually also have a bar license now as well. We used to just operate with a restaurant license, but we built a little pony wall and delineated the bar area from the rest of the restaurant, and now that area is 21 and over and actually operates with a bar license. So you can come in and have some drinks, and you actually don't have to eat any longer because, we're operating with those two licenses at the same time.
Okay, so for listeners who are fairly new to Utah, can you deep dive into how the bar license and the restaurant license work?
So before, when we operated with just a restaurant license, we ran into some hiccups because under the restaurant license, you have to order food. There's the intent to dine, which is when you're looking at the menu, which allows you to order that first drink, but then you do need to order some food. And then there's also some stipulations on sales numbers, where alcohol sales versus food numbers with the restaurant license. But now that we have the bar license in that area, the hotel guests and, you know, locals and everybody else can just come in and get a drink if they want to, which was something we ran into with issues in the past. Was we have hotel guests that are staying for 5 days to a week, and sometimes they eat in Versante three nights a week, but sometimes they want to go try some of the other delicious food that we have in Park City, but they still want to kind of hang out and have a drink or two before they go. So now we have the capability of facilitating that without forcing food down their throats.
Cool. So will it be an après-ski spot? Because it's perfect location.
Oh, yeah. We
are out of town.
Yeah, as soon as as winter hits, we'll be operating the bar area from 4 to 11.
And you'll also have a lunch at that point as well?
Lunch we're going to skip. It'll just be breakfast for the hotel. Well, and hopefully we'll expand that to being open to the public. And then we'll shut down and then open for the bar at 4 and then the restaurant at 5.
So is there enough parking with all the construction going on?
Currently, parking is definitely limited and a little tight, but we're getting to the light at the end of the tunnel phase for the construction, so hopefully the parking will start expanding more and more as the days come.
Good. Anything else you want to share with our listeners?
Just that we're open. I mean, we're there. We're ready. We've got the staff. We're kind of hanging out. We've been with the hotel on the temporary suspension of operations, that whole front area is capable for parking too. A lot of people will pull in and not be able to find a spot around the corner and think there's no spaces, but we can fill that whole front entryway up with cars right now. So if you can find somewhere to put your car, you can put your car there.
Excellent.
Tuck on the grass if you need to.
Yeah. Before we jump, do you have a signature cocktail? Like if I finish a day of skiing and I swing by there, what should I order to drink?
Right now we've got a couple that people really like. We've got one that's the Harmony Drop. It's got some Kettle One Botanical in it, some blackberry liqueur, and then some lemon juice. It's kind of a twist on a lemon drop. Mm. And then we also have a Gravedigger cocktail that's just a pretty stiff old fashioned. But our resident bartenders are working diligently on upping the menu for the winter. So changing the flavors, we're still kind of running with our summer flavors and switching over to our fall right now. So there's definitely more in the works right now.
And a nice wine list?
Yeah, the wine list is definitely, we run pretty slim, and we're about to expand it a lot. I've actually had a couple different wine reps in showing me some fantastic stuff, and we're about to expand the wine list pretty substantially.
Wonderful. Is there a website?
We actually just received our own website. We used to just have the Peaks Hotel website, and we were a page on that website, but our own personal website, versantehearthandbar.com, just launched, and so you can go over there, check that out. It's got our list of specials that we're running today, or this currently outside of the Dineabout. We're doing a Kids Eat for $1 on Wednesdays. On Thursdays, we have a specialty sandwich for $15. Fridays and Saturdays, we're doing complimentary corkage, and then on Sundays, you can get a buy one pizza, get one half off.
Wow.
Yeah, and those are all dine-in only promotions, but we're running all those to try and get our locals back in there that we've missed so dearly this summer.
Yeah. And do you have, do you take reservations?
We do.
On the website or on one of those other things?
If you search Versante on Google, you can make the reservations and you can actually order online. We, everything's through Toast. It's a pretty awesome system that's been taking over all the restaurants in the area, but it's pretty intuitive and user-friendly. So all of our reservations are through that, our online ordering, and we actually just started offering delivery through Uber Eats as well.
So. Wonderful. So we just spent a few minutes with Andrew McKay and Casey Savage of Versante and Peaks Hotel. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Delilah Gervais has been working in the beauty world for over a quarter century, with nearly 20 of those years with her store, Splendor, out in Redstone. We're lucky to be joined by her this morning to learn about her store, her success, and what the next 20 years may have in store. 20 years over in Redstone. That's about the same time that Redstone opened, I believe.
Yeah, I think myself and Alan Toys is probably the OGs that are left out there.
So can you share with us a little bit about the path that led you to the opening of Splendor?
Sure. I mean, I moved here nearly 23 years ago and was working in Park City and just noticed we had a really sophisticated community and not a lot of options for a luxury product as far as shopping. And so we started in 2005, in a 500 square foot space at Redstone. And in 2015, we moved up to 2,000 square feet.
Excellent. And so you were in the beauty world before you opened Splendor. Can you explain a little bit about that background?
Yes, it was never my intention. I was raised by a single father, so the beauty world was not really discussed in my household. I was just kind of having to figure it out on my own. And when I went to college, I majored in broadcasting, ironically. I worked for King 5 Television in Seattle for a little while and decided that was not my track and was recruited to work for a plastic surgery conglomerate in marketing. And then from there, my love for medical grade skincare grew and I went to work for that company, became an esthetician, and the rest is history.
And that's kind of a natural segue to the kinds of products that you stock at Splendor. Can you share a little bit about, you know, when you first started, you mentioned what you were trying to do. Let's talk about how you put that into practice.
Yeah, I mean, when we started, I had very limited budget to open my business. And I believe we probably opened with 7 brands, of which we still carry 5 today. And over the years, we've grown to about 300 vendors, which is not fun to manage, but mm-hmm. It creates a really unique mix for our customers. So they can come in and find a brand that they're very familiar and comfortable with, but also find these little surprises in these smaller indie brands that we carry.
Gotcha. Now, is that confusing for someone to walk in looking for, let's say, a foundation or something, having too many choices? I know myself, I would just get...
I mean, for a man, it probably would be.
Yeah, Kevin always does a good job with his foundation, I must say.
I mean, I think that people can be intimidated to walk in and if they don't have a lot of knowledge about the product, but our job is to educate them and offer that service. And we are so much more than makeup. When I opened in 2005, my goal was makeup and skincare, and we stayed true to that for a very long time. But we found that the community was really wanting more gift items, more fragrance items. And so we just listened to our customers. And so we grew within those categories. And honestly, gift is probably 60% of our business.
Wow. Okay. But you also have services there.
We do. We have a skin bar and we offer lash extensions, facials, dermaplaning, microneedling, all the good stuff. And we like to refer to it as more of an express experience than going to a spa and spending 3 hours lounging.
Gotcha. So 20 years, your anniversary is coming up. I believe you have some celebrations later this week.
We do. Starting the 16th through the 18th, we've got something happening every single day. It's on our Instagram posted. It's a lot to go through, but essentially we had to spread it over 3 days because there was so much we wanted to do for our customers. One of the things I'm most excited about is the Peace House has always been close to my heart. And so every year we make donations to that organization. And what we decided to do with our party is I've got a huge basket of tons of product. It's well over $500. And we want the proceeds of that to benefit the Peace House. So with every $5 donated at our event to the Peace House, customers will get an entry to fill out to put into the basket. So $25 gets 5 entries and so on.
You know, 20 years, can we talk a little bit about how the nature of the products you sell have evolved? Even the stuff that you sold the whole time, the whole makeup, you know, how has makeup changed in the last 20 years?
Well, just like anything, there's been technological advances in skincare and makeup. There's just a lot more money being poured into research for it and finding all sorts of new and exciting things that keep us young. Packaging has also changed a lot. A lot of companies are going to reusable and disposable, proper disposable packaging rather than filling the dumps, so to say. Yeah. You know, back when I started, really good effective skincare was pretty harsh and it was intimidating to kind of start a program. But nowadays they've been able to encapsulate those ingredients that really make a difference in the skin so that it's a lot more gentle of a process.
Yeah, excellent. So you mentioned your, we're just hopscotching back and forth.
Sure.
So your Instagram is what? So people can find the...
Splendor Beauty, at Splendor Beauty.
Okay. And each day is something different. Are there any other specials, like if a man wants to go in there and get a... needling or whatever?
What is it? Microneedling.
There you go.
I'm not offering any promotions on our skin bar services, but our store for all 3 days is 20% off online as well as in store. And with online shoppers, you can have that shipped to you or you can pick up in store. We also have makeup lessons. We're doing a custom hat bar with my favorite local artist. And you can design your own patches to go on your hat, or you can use some of the ones that she and I have designed. We're also debuting our Charm Bar by Katie Waltman on Saturday the 18th, which is really exciting for me. And then in addition to that, Trish McAvoy, which is our lead makeup line, is going to be offering the makeup lessons.
Well, I wish we could spend more time, but we have to cut out for NPR News. But we've just spent some time with Delila Gervais of Splendor, right in the middle of Redstone. Check it out on Thursday, Friday, Saturday this week.
Please subscribe to the Mountain Money Podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.